Welcome, listeners, to a special bonus episode of Undisclosed. We've got two very cool sponsors this week. First up is the highly anticipated drama Conviction, premiering on October 3rd, this fall, on ABC, and Stamps.com. Make sure you listen in for the spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy.
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Strang.
Hello.
Hi, how are you? This is Rabia Chaudhary.
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much.
Hi, and welcome to a special episode of Undisclosed. First, I want to wish our U.S. listeners a great Labor Day weekend. And as the country takes a break from work, so is the Undisclosed team. But actually, we're only taking a break from Joey's case. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and you can find out a lot more about my work, links to my blog, and to my book, Adnan's Story, by going to rabiachaudhary.com. Susan and Colin are taking a little bit of well-deserved time off, but they'll be back with us next week. So, I had the pleasure of interviewing someone whose name became known across the globe with the incredible Netflix series, Making a Murderer. And that is attorney Dean Strang, who represented Stephen Avery, the main defendant. You might recall that along with Avery, his nephew, Brendan Dassey, was also convicted of the murder of Teresa Halbach. Now Dassey, who was 17 at the time, was sentenced to life in 2007. It's been an eventful summer for wrongful convictions, what with Adnan's conviction being overturned in June, and then, on August 12th, the stunning news that Dassey's conviction had also been thrown out.
Now at 5, breaking news coming out of federal court. Brendan Dassey could soon be a free man.
The sensational new developments in the case profiled in the documentary Making a Murderer.
That's right. A federal judge in Wisconsin overturning the conviction of Brendan Dassey, who was found guilty of helping his uncle Stephen.
Judge William Duffin's decision points out investigators repeatedly told Dassey that they already knew what he did and assured him he had nothing to worry about. The judge ruled Dassey's confession was unconstitutional.
And in Avery's case, the fight also continues, most recently with a filing by his well-known attorney, Kathleen Zellner, in which she makes some incredible allegations that evidence was deliberately planted against her client by the police.
We're requesting to test dozens of items from the crime scene. These tests are going to establish definitively the age of the blood in the victim's vehicle. And we're also going to be able to get test results that we believe will completely exonerate Mr. Avery.
Now, my interview with Dean Strang took place before these developments, but it will tell us a lot about what went wrong in both Avery and Dassey's cases.
So I was lucky enough last week to get a sneak preview of a new TV series coming to ABC this fall on Monday nights. It's called Conviction, and I think listeners of Undisclosed are going to love it. It's inspired by the real-life conviction integrity units that have been forming in prosecutors' offices across the country with the goal of evaluating old convictions. The show stars Haley Atwell of Marvel's Agent Carter as leader of New York's newly formed CIU. Hayes Morrison is a brilliant lawyer, but she has her own legal struggles that have threatened to derail her career. And she's forced to take on the undesirable post of head of the new CIU. The show also stars Eddie Cahill from CSI New York and, my favorite, Emily Kinney of The Walking Dead. Each week, the team from Conviction investigates a new case, trying to figure out whether the system got it right the first time around, or if this is another wrongful conviction that slipped through the cracks. The show deals with a lot of the same issues that we cover on Undisclosed, including problems of forensic evidence, the dangers of witness identification, and, of course, Brady violations. It also focuses on a fascinating issue we haven't covered, the political tensions and conflicting motivations that are intrinsic to the creation of the conviction review unit that is itself a part of the prosecutor's office that made that conviction in the first place. Conviction will be on ABC Mondays this fall at 10 p.m. 9 Central, starting on October 3rd, following Dancing with the Stars. I'll be watching.
So, Mr. Strang, you are currently a principal at Strang Bradley, which is your law firm, correct?
Yes, one of two owners of the firm.
Can you tell us about your career before you took on Avery's case? Had you been practicing criminal defense for long?
I had. I'd been practicing criminal defense since September 1988. I don't know if that qualifies as long or not, but
that's fairly significant.
It's coming on 28 years now. Before that, I very briefly was a federal prosecutor in Milwaukee, and before that, I had an enjoyable 2.5+ years at a relatively large civil law firm in Milwaukee.
I'm an attorney myself, but I've never worked in the criminal system. I haven't done criminal law at all. So I always wonder about when prosecutors then decide to practice defense law. Was there some reason that you made that shift?
Well, it's hard to think of me as a prosecutor. My stint in the United States Attorney's Office lasted all of 10.5 months, and it was my first introduction to criminal law. I liked criminal law very much, but, you know, was on the wrong side for me, was not happy or effective as a prosecutor. So it was a situation of loving the shoes, but having them on the wrong feet.
Well, I mean, you learned that pretty quickly. 10 months in is fairly quick. A lot of times it takes people years to figure out where they don't belong.
Well, I learned it by 6 months in and had an opportunity to leave after 6 months and said, I can't leave a job after 6 months. And so I stayed for a few more months and just couldn't do it anymore and was an awful prosecutor. I was probably the worst federal prosecutor ever born.
Were you very easy on folks? Is that what happened?
No, it's not that. I felt constrained by, you know, the Department of Justice policy and policies within the office not to do what I thought often would have been the better thing to do. Mm. So it's not that I was easy on people. It's just that I bristled against the size of the organization and the constraints within which we had to work. And I simply did not like being the defender of the status quo.
So when you took on Stephen Avery's case at that point, he had been exonerated in 2003 of the first crime that he had been convicted of, the assault and rape of a woman. I'm assuming because he had become fairly well known in Wisconsin due to like the legislation that was drafted in his name, you must have known who he was when he was rearrested.
Oh, I certainly did. In fact, I had known years before because in the mid-1990s, in his first effort to clear himself through DNA testing. Of course, he had tried through the direct appeal process to clear himself, but then some years later, in the mid-1990s, as I say, when DNA testing had become widely available, he made a first effort at a collateral attack of his conviction. And I was with a wonderful law firm then and for about 8.5 years called Shell O'Shaughlin Glynn. That's the firm that represented him in his mid-90s effort to secure his freedom. And so although I had either none or negligible personal involvement, it was a firm of just 7 lawyers and 2 wonderful lawyers at that firm, Steve Glynn and Rob Hennick, were handling his case directly at that point. He, by the way, was excluded in that round of DNA testing, but that testing did not identify the correct culprit. So even the exclusion in the mid-90s was insufficient to prick the consciences of the Wisconsin courts that looked at it to set aside that conviction.
So the exclusion alone wasn't enough. Then what happened? Was there further testing that then matched the perpetrator?
Later, with more sensitive DNA testing, and B, with the development of a databank of offenders, 7 or 8 years later, when now the only thing that remained that could be tested that hadn't been destroyed or lost in previous testing was one hair, is what it came down to. That DNA testing in the early 2000s again excluded Mr. Avery, but this time identified the actual rapist. And it was finally then that the Wisconsin courts relented and freed Stephen Avery in September 2003.
I want to circle back to this incredible resistance of the state and courts to look at evidence. Like, for example, you said that he was clearly excluded from the DNA. I mean, it's almost shocking to the conscience, but I want to talk to you a little bit later about why you think that happens. But I want to ask you a question. I saw an interview of yours in which you said that when the case came to you in 2006, after he was arrested for Teresa Halbach's murder, you called him the most hated man in Wisconsin. I didn't kind of understand that because I assumed that after he had been exonerated and, you know, he had a lot of public support with this lawsuit, you know, for his wrongful conviction, I would assume that he would not have been the most hated man, that he would actually have had a lot of public support even after his arrest again.
When he was released in September 2003, there was, of course, a wave of public support for him, or at least, I think, public revulsion at the idea of an innocent man spending 18 years in prison, and the actual rapist having gone on to commit at least one more violent rape, the one for which he was serving 60 years by the time he was identified in 2003 as the rapist from the 1985 case. So outside of Manitowoc County and that sort of corner of northeast Wisconsin, Mr. Avery was widely embraced as someone to whom a great wrong had been done by the criminal justice system. In Manitowoc County, even then in 2003, there was a noticeable minority of people, including some within the law enforcement community, actively engaged in counterfactual thinking, you know, actively speculating that somehow maybe Mr. Avery still had been involved in that 1985 rape. Maybe there were two assailants, you know, not just one or something. You know, I say counterfactual thinking because the victim was very clear that only one man had ever attacked her and raped her. In Manitowoc and around Manitowoc County, there were, you know, a minority, but sort of vocal or visible minority of people engaged in that kind of counterfactual imaginary thinking. Elsewhere in the state, people rightly accepted very quickly that this had been a terrible miscarriage of justice. Mm. And specifically, many politicians from both of the major political parties embraced Mr. Avery, both figuratively and physically. So, you know, he shot to prominence in the 2 years after his release in 2003. When he was arrested for Teresa Halbach's murder, and indeed for the week or so before his arrest, when it was clear to any thinking viewer that the police were focused immediately on him as a suspect before they even knew there'd been a murder, his fall from grace could not have been more precipitous in the public mind. So by the time he was arrested, or very shortly after his arrest in early November 2005, there was outrage by the public, a sense of betrayal. Here's a man who had been wrongfully convicted. Everyone wanted the story to turn out with a happy ending. And instead, 2 years plus after his release, here he is charged with an even more horrific crime. And I do think my sense, you know, having lived in Wisconsin all my life, including then, my sense is that there was an unarticulated sense of betrayal on the part of the public. You won your release. You won our sympathy. You won our anger at a system that would wrongly imprison you. And then with your liberty, you use it to go out and kill somebody. I think that was the public sentiment broadly.
That would, require a tremendous amount of trust in the police and, you know, prosecutors that this time they got it right, which, again, I guess I'm just a little surprised, or maybe I've just become more of a skeptic that having been through this with him specifically before, that they would have not been so trusting in the police narrative.
I think the broader public, at least in Wisconsin and outside of, you know, small pockets in Milwaukee or Madison or elsewhere, the broader public does have a high baseline trust in the competence of law enforcement officials. And that was fed by the press conferences that were conducted while Ms. Halbach was a missing person, and then after Mr. Avery's arrest, in which the police and ultimately a prosecutor asserted a very confident belief that they now had knowledge of Mr. Avery's guilt, what he had done. There was an implicit claim of superior knowledge. You know, if you knew what we knew, based on all the information we have that we can't share with you, we believe confidently that this man is guilty of this horrible crime. And that narrative got seeded in the public mind very quickly with some repeated press conferences and public assertions by the law enforcement community, including the special prosecutor.
Right. I was actually, when I watched Making a Murderer, I was really struck by these press conferences, which, again, I mean, I haven't practiced criminal defense law, so I want to ask you, as somebody who has for almost 30 years, is that common or is that odd? I mean, I found it a little bit unethical.
No, they're not common. And I would disagree with the description of unethical, at least as to the press conferences that preceded the discovery of Ms. Halbach's remains and then an arrest and charging decision. I think the press conferences up to that time were appropriate, not necessary, but at least appropriate in the sense of seeking public help. People who may have seen Ms. Halbach or had clues to her whereabouts or been interested in volunteering to search for her. All really appropriate in my view. Once there was an arrest and charging decision, and now, you know, a whole set of constitutional obligations to provide a fair trial to an actual person accused arise, then the press conferences became of more concern. They were unusual. I see press conferences like this only in the, you know, tiny sliver of cases that attract broad public interest or attention. And the most problematic of the press conferences actually didn't occur for another 4 months. March 1 and March 2, 2006 are the press conferences by the special prosecutor that were of the greatest ethical concern and just concern to anyone who takes seriously the obligation to provide a fair trial.
Sheriff Poggle and I will be releasing to the media the specifics of this case. I will be filing, as I mentioned, a criminal complaint tomorrow, and by 2 p.m., that will be available for release to all of you.
Ms. Krebs, can you tell us, because of what's happened with the 16-year-old, might the charges that exist now against Stephen Avery change or become less, like he had less of a role?
No.
Are the buildings you're searching today buildings that you've already searched?
Yes.
Search
we have done extensive searches of every building on that property with the degree of specificity that we received this week, knowing exactly what to look for and exactly where to look for it, led to the issuance of today's search warrant.
What happened in those press conferences?
Those happened after Mr. Avery's 16-year-old nephew, Brendan Dassey, was arrested and then within a day or so gave some statements to the police while in custody that you see if you watch Making a Murderer. You see excerpts of that police interview of Brendan Dassey while he was in custody. And it's those two press conferences that provided the lurid details that formed the prosecution narrative well before trial and that spoke to the public about there being a confession or admissions by a young man in custody, and then also that young man's supposed accusations against his uncle, went into a great deal of really lurid, unforgettable, and ugly detail that later the physical evidence all but entirely undermined.
Brendan Dassey's arrest and involvement and his role in this entire case, I know, has been very, very disturbing to people who watch Making a Murderer. It still is because he's still incarcerated. And, you know, when you watched when I watched the documentary, both with Brendan and with Stephen, I just sense that these were two particularly vulnerable individuals. I don't know if it's like education or IQ or just what it was, but. And I wondered if that was why the police really focused on them or thought that You said that even before there was knowledge that Teresa Halbach had actually been killed, the police already had been looking at Stephen Avery. So what was it about Stephen Avery specifically, do you think, that made the police come back to him?
Well, Stephen Avery had been a longtime usual suspect, if you will, from a disfavored family viewed as a sort of a grubby clan in that part of the world. He had a long police record or sort of series of contacts with the police, some of them really fairly minor offenses, but also eye-catching, you know, offenses, the accusation of animal cruelty for burning a cat, for example, just, you know, sort of gut-grabbing behavior for a couple of them. And then, of course, he was suing the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department and the DA's office in the county for $36 million for the wrongful conviction. And I think the wrongful conviction, I suspect, was extraordinarily humiliating and embarrassing to the people who involved in procuring it and to the department and those in the department, whether they had any direct involvement in that earlier case or not. I mean, a clearly innocent man went to prison and stayed there. And indeed, some years later, when a phone call was made to the sheriff's department from a Green Bay law enforcement agency, that phone call was ignored, right, which, you know, alerted the sheriff's department that an innocent man might be in prison. And perhaps most of all, back in 1985, at the time of the initial investigation, the Manitowoc City Police Department had it right, identified the correct suspect back then, brought that information to the sheriff's department, and was rebuffed by the sheriff's department. They were focused on Stephen Avery. They were not interested in the city police department's identification of and concerns about the man who turned out to be the actual rapist. So I think that this was a very humiliating sequence of events that then was being brought to light in Stephen's civil lawsuit, with the possibility of real civil damages, I mean, millions of dollars attached to it. But beyond that, I think the possibility and the likelihood of personal shame and embarrassment and sort of public humiliation of the people and the department involved.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that Serial and many other of these, you know, kind of wrongful conviction stories that are coming to light in the last couple of years are showing people is that it's not uncommon for the police to often focus in on a suspect and then build a case around that suspect, even to the extent of ignoring glaring evidence showing that they should look at other leads. You hear this over and over again, especially in wrongful convictions. I wanted to ask you about the lawsuit, actually. I mean, I know that after Stephen Avery was arrested, the lawsuit was actually settled for much less than $36 million. But I wanted to know if any of the actors, the state actors that were the subject of the lawsuit, were ever sanctioned for their role in his wrongful conviction.
They were not. There was mild criticism, I guess, in the attorney general's investigation of the department, although most of that final report from the investigation, I think, focused in a sense more constructively on what we might do better going forward. And the criticism was guarded and even oblique of the department and the individuals themselves.
Nobody lost their job or lost their law license or anything like that?
No. No, they didn't. There were no sanctions. One of the officers who was involved back in 1985 directly in the investigation, in fact, had risen to sheriff by 2003 when Mr. Avery was released.
When you're working a full-time job and producing a full-time podcast, there's nothing you hate more than wasted time. And nothing used to waste my time more than trips to the post office. But now, I can get my mailing and shipping done without ever leaving my desk, thanks to Stamps.com. Stamps.com turns your PC or Mac into your own personal post office that never closes. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your computer and printer. Then, you just hand the mail to your mailman, or you drop it in the mailbox. And right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So go to Stamps.com before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com, enter UNDISCLOSED.
Can I ask you how often in your career you've come across police department or DA misconduct? When we see stories like Stephen Avery's and others, it just seems so egregious, and it seems like this must be something that rarely happens. So I'm asking you from your experience, have you seen this in other of your clients?
Well, let's start with the understanding that every police officer also is a human being, and they have the same failings and biases and weaknesses that other human beings have. But if we use the 2005 murder case against Mr. Avery as a mark of a case in which there are at least reasonable inferences that some evidence may have been planted, outright manufactured by the police. So if we start with that, I would say my personal experience with that is almost nil beyond this case. I've never, I think, that I can remember right now anyway, run into another case in which the reasonableness of the inference of actual manufactured or planted evidence was as strong or readily available as it was in this case. Now, that said, once you sort of slide down the scale, do you run into police officers who spin, you know, in their description of a suspect's statements in custody or his actions frequently? Do you run into exaggeration by police officers? Sure, with some frequency. Do you run into sloppiness in investigations all the time? I mean, no investigation is perfect. Is the sloppiness meaningful, or is it just, you know, sort of casualness around the edges? You know, sometimes it's meaningful, more often it's just sort of casual sloppiness that probably doesn't have really significant consequences. And if you slide further down the scale and look at instances where police officers act on an initial hunch and then try to conform all further information they acquire to that initial hunch to support it, right, acting on confirmation bias, in other words, that's very common in the way it would be for all human beings. I mean, we all are susceptible to confirmation bias. I mean, just to give a very prosaic or a harmless example, you and I might look through a magazine and see an ad for a new automobile, and it catches our eye. We think it's just a great looking car and it looks exciting and we can see ourselves in it. We may end up buying that car, even though if we sat down with Consumer Reports or read the car magazines or shopped around closely, there might be five other cars that actually would be better suited to our lifestyles or our needs, or, would be more reliable, better performing automobiles. But once we settle on something, we often then look for reasons to confirm that initial choice or predilection. And that's just human. Right. And police officers are as vulnerable to that, I think, as everybody else. Now, their training ought to warn them against that tendency, but you see confirmation bias, or you could think of it as tunnel vision, on the part of police officers very commonly.
Can I ask you, I'm sure in this case, you talked about Stephen Avery's robust interactions with the law and how he was kind of a usual suspect to begin with, and I'm sure this fed into their confirmation bias. How many of those instances, were his previous bad acts introduced at trial?
They were not. None of his prior record was introduced at trial. The judge was very clear early on that he was not interested in seeing earlier bad acts being introduced at trial. Many of them were included in the film by the filmmakers, I think, I assume, to give an unvarnished or unairbrushed picture of Stephen Avery, but they weren't evidence at trial.
Can I ask you to explain that to our listeners? Why wouldn't somebody's previous criminal record be introduced at trial? I mean, doesn't that have some kind of weight, significance? Tell us what kind of person this is.
Well, the fear of courts for hundreds of years in the English-speaking world is actually that juries will give it too much weight. It's considered character evidence or propensity evidence. And while there are lots of exceptions where other bad acts can come into evidence, the general rule is that they don't, because the fact that you've done something distasteful or bad in the past is likely to have an over-important role in the jury's consideration of the evidence of the current charge defense.
I also wanted to ask you to explain something else about how this entire case unfolded with reference to Brendan Dassey, and, because you didn't represent Brendan Dassey, right?
No.
And so that's something that also it might be unclear about why in a case like this you have co-defendants, it's the same crime. Why do different attorneys represent them? And are you precluded from doing that? And how do the two different cases have an impact on each other?
Well, these days, in the modern era, a lawyer can represent only one defendant charged with, you know, a given crime, even though there may be several charged with the same crime as accomplices. And the reason for that is just conflict of interest. If A, B, and C are charged with a given crime, A may very well have a reason to point the finger at B and or C as being either the actual perpetrators or at least the more culpable of the perpetrators. And B and C will have the same incentive. A lawyer then can't serve two masters. You can't be representing A and B and have A pointing the finger at B and B pointing the finger at A. Each of those clients is entitled to a lawyer with undivided loyalties. So that's the reason that I or any lawyer would have been able to represent only Stephen Avery or only Brendan Dassey and not the other.
Were you surprised by the verdict in this case? Did you expect a guilty verdict?
I expected a guilty verdict in this sense. I tell myself in every trial, as soon as the closing arguments are done, that I'm going to lose. That's just the mind frame I try to get myself into while a jury is out deliberating. I try to have the opposite mindset before I'm giving my closing argument, you know, and during it. I try to be focused on why my client's cause is right, why the correct verdict is to acquit him or whatever, you know, whatever it is that
sure.
we're seeking with a verdict. But as soon as the arguments are over, I make a very conscious effort to flip that and to tell myself we're going to lose. I act like we're going to lose. I start drafting post-trial motions while the jury's out deliberating as if I'm going to lose. And the reason I do that is just I find guilty verdicts so taxing and crushing as a defense lawyer that I have to gird myself for it in advance. It's much easier to take the happy surprise of an acquittal than it is to be expecting an acquittal and take the unhappy surprise of a guilty verdict.
Do you tell your clients to do that too as they're awaiting during deliberations?
No, I don't. I usually give my clients my best honest objective assessment of how the trial went right through the closing arguments, how it all went. But I really leave it to them to decide emotionally what to expect or how to feel. I really think that's something where a lawyer oughtn't be robbing them of their autonomy.
Yeah. You've said in a number of interviews now, when people ask you pointedly about how you feel about Stephen Avery, that you make the distinction that you think he should be not guilty, but not necessarily that he's innocent. And can you explain that distinction also? You know, I think this is kind of a moral dilemma for people. If somebody is actually guilty and they're found guilty, even though the means aren't proper, then what's the problem here, right? So can you talk a little bit about this distinction and why you make it?
Sure. Every trial is to be a search for the truth in a current or prospective way. But searching for the truth, noble as that is and right as that is, as a framework for a trial, searching for the truth doesn't guarantee you that you will find the truth. And very often at the end of a trial, the truth remains obscured or murky, uncertain. A great deal of uncertainty really remains at the end of many trials, criminal or civil. and deciding a verdict generally is, I think, more about deciding the greater weight of the evidence and which inferences from well-established or even indisputable facts, which inferences ought to be drawn as opposed to other possible reasonable inferences or conclusions from those facts. And many facts, in other words, including the ultimate facts of guilt or innocence, often are debatable after we've done our best to search for the truth. And so because we're not omniscient and yet have to make a decision in the present, to me, the question we ought to be asking is, was a case proven by the necessary standard or was it not? The question, you know, are you innocent or are you guilty? That, if you're a believer, that's St. Peter's question when you meet him, you know. That's a godlike question, and one looking back at a lifetime with the benefit of whatever hindsight and omniscience may be acquired. We're not St. Peter. We don't have that seat and that perspective. So I think for human beings, the question really has to be, was it proven or not? Then you get down to, okay, if error is a possibility and even likely from time to time, on which side do you err? Do you err on the side of depriving someone of liberty preemptively or on the concern that they may have done something bad or might in the future, or do you err on the side of liberty and faith in, you know, the idea that most human beings do good things with their liberty, not bad things? That's a fundamental question. Our system is set up to err on the side of liberty, but I don't know that we implement those principles faithfully very often at all.
Right. Stephen Avery's attorney currently, Kathleen Zellner, who is very well known for her work on wrongful convictions, has been very, very public about her belief that he's innocent. What is the sense that you get in terms of his chances now? Do you think he might get a new trial or an exoneration? Do you think he has another opportunity at this?
I sure hope so. I sure hope so. I've never, ever been anything close to comfortable with the rectitude of this verdict, its correctness, its fairness, or its decency, or its justice. And I very much hope that further work on this case and the passage of time will result in significant new evidence that will secure Mr. Avery's freedom, or at the very least, a new trial, at which his guilt can be reexamined with better and more evidence.
As somebody who is deeply involved in Adnan's case, and, you know, I was on Serial a couple of times, and, you know, the book I'm written, I know you've been through and still are going through kind of the similar thing where people are treating this very real story, a case, a man's life and many lives, sometimes almost as fiction. There is a sense of celebrity that's gotten attached to people who are involved in these cases. And I've noticed with you, I mean, even things like, I mean, I actually follow a Twitter account called Sexy Dean Strang. Do you know about that Twitter account?
I'm aware of that, but I'm not on Twitter.
Okay.
I'm sorry you're following it.
You know, after making a murder, I was looking for you and on Twitter, and that's what I found. So I thought, okay, it's close enough. It's a fun account to follow. And there's also a Tumblr that's devoted to you called Strangcore. So I just want to ask, do you get recognized? And how has the experience of this documentary and all this publicity impacted your work?
Well, I get recognized frequently, and that's tapering off a little bit. 4 or 5 months ago, I got recognized a lot, and people could place me. I mean, aren't you the lawyer from Making a Murderer? Well, yes, one of them.
Right.
Now, often, interestingly, they recognize me but can't place me. Did you give a presentation at my company at some point? Or,
it's a very short memory.
You know, I had a flight attendant ask me within the last week, do you fly a lot? Are you, you know, if I had you as a you know, a passenger before? Yeah, and then, you know, and then eventually, you know, they sort out, or the light bulb, you know, the recollection comes back. But
right. But
that happens frequently. And in terms of impact on my work, this, like any case that gets a lot of publicity, leads to a spike in letters from prisoners or their family members who are desperate, who are grasping for some fragment of hope And that's been the primary impact on my work, as it is, as I say, every time you have a case that draws real publicity.
Yeah. I just want to end by asking you a little bit about what you're doing going forward. And I also want to tell our listeners that you have actually written, you've published one book, correct? Called Worse Than the Devil?
Yes. It's the story of a trial in 1917 and its aftermath. And Clarence Darrow's role in that was as the appellate lawyer, not as the trial lawyer. So it was an atypical undertaking for Clarence Darrow. He's rightly much better remembered as a trial lawyer than an appellate lawyer.
Actually, I ordered recently, so I'm looking forward to getting that and reading that. And I hope our listeners too. But can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing? I've heard about that there's something called the Conversation on Justice Tour that you're part of, and also a documentary series.
The Conversation on Justice, yes, is an effort that Jerry Buting, my co-counsel in the Avery case, and I are undertaking jointly. We've gone to 20 cities in the United States, general audience, moderated question and answer format, using the Avery and Dassey cases and the film about them as a springboard into some broader systemic issues of the American criminal justice system that also would be common to almost any criminal justice system that humans can devise.
And can you tell us a little bit about the Road to Justice documentary series?
I wouldn't describe it as a documentary series. If it happens, if it makes it to air, it will be an unscripted series. Each episode will examine one current or contemporary case that raises, you know, broad and serious questions on the reliability or accuracy of the process or the outcome. Now, some of these will still be going to trial. Some of them will be well after trial, on appeal, or even years after the direct appeal, but still in the courts in some fashion. And then through the season, there will be a thread running of one historical case in which a miscarriage of justice is clear and obvious, either a wrongful acquittal or a wrongful conviction. And that through line, that historical through line, I think will help viewers to gauge where we've made real progress in the United States in administering criminal justice and where things today look very much like they did 50, 75, or 100 years ago, where we've made very little progress in addressing recurrent systemic weaknesses. So we'll see if that gets to air, but that's the concept of Road to Justice.
Well, I certainly hope it does, because you have many, many people who've been following your work, and it sounds like conceptually a great way to educate the public about these issues. So thank you so much again for joining us, and I look forward to your work, and I hope to actually be able to catch you in one of your speaking engagements sometime and meeting you.
Thanks for talking with me today. This was really a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mr. Strang.
If there was ever any doubt about the power of media, and in this day and age, the power of social media, to help right tremendous wrongs, it should really be put to rest now. The overturned convictions of both Adnan and Brendan are proof positive, as are many other cases. And this season, we hope to do the same for Joey. It's not about entertainment. It's about justice. Next time on Undisclosed.
And that wraps up this week's special bonus episode of Undisclosed. Hey, before you go, check it out. We've got a trailer for one of our favorite podcasts produced by one of our producers. The name of that podcast, it's Actual Innocence. Listen in.
Wrongful convictions are more common than you might think.
I spent almost 17 years in prison for a first-degree murder I did not commit.
Here are the struggles of those who've been wrongly accused.
They all said I'm arrested in front of my home. I thought it was a stick-up.
Wrongly convicted.
They assigned to him Charles Nelson Plowden, who was a tax lawyer.
And unjustly incarcerated for crimes they did not commit.
But when you're innocent, you got armor around your morale, and it's nothing that can beat it down.
Listen, learn, and advocate. with the Actual Innocence Podcast.
That's awesome. Seriously, go check out Actual Innocence. It's an Audio Boom podcast. It's great. I listen to every episode. I guarantee that if you do too, you're going to love it. And let's get on to the credits. First up, as always, we got to thank the Georgia Innocence Project. They are busting their butts down there trying to release the wrongfully convicted in the great state of Georgia. Please help them out. Go to their website and donate a little something something. Their website is www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. It was very, very cool for Susan to do a read for ABC's upcoming drama Conviction. Again, it debuts on October 3rd. That's a Monday, folks. It's easy to remember. It's the same day that Undisclosed comes out. Watch it. We think you'll enjoy it. We know Susan enjoyed it. The rest of the crew is going to enjoy it when we start watching the episodes. So make sure you support ABC's new show about trying to exonerate the wrongfully convicted. And of course, Stamps. Stamps is a constant sponsor for us. We appreciate them very much. Thank you, Stamps, for continuing to support Undisclosed efforts to bring our audience a cool podcast. On to the folks behind the scenes. Rebecca Lavoie of Crime Writers On and Partners in Crime Media makes this show sound great. She gets help from Han McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence Podcast. Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez did our theme music. Baluki did our logo. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams on the website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com. Did you all know we also put on an addendum on Thursday and that addendum is hosted by Mr. John Cryer? Even better, you can tweet him questions for that addendum. He might read them. All you got to do is go on the social medias, use the hashtag UDAddendum, tweet him a question, and maybe he'll read it on the show. And where are those social medias, you ask? Well, we're on the Twitters, the Facebook, the Instagrams. You can find us at Undisclosed Pod. That's our handle. Lastly, and definitely most leastly, your executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to bringing the episode of content back to you next week for Undisclosed Episode 9. Until then.